Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Misha Kapustin. He is a rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia. We're going to be talking about his life, his work, his community, his travels, his thinking, his writings, all kinds of things. A fascinating individual who has gone through many interesting experiences in his life. Again, Misha Kapustin, rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia. We'll be right back. Misha, how are you today?
Thank you, I'm very well. What about yourself?
I'm doing extremely well, considering it's very cold in our community. And what's the weather like in Slovakia today?
Look, I don't know I don't know how to say how it's like, you know, in Fahrenheit, but in Celsius it's about zero.
All right.
No snow.
So we know where Slovakia is. It is the Republic, which used to be a part of the larger Republic of Czechoslovakia, but is now a separate nation, has been for a couple of decades now, and its capital is Bratislava, correct?
Yes, everything is correct, yes.
Now, so that everybody understands that Bratislava has a great significance in itself, correct me if I'm wrong, but Slovakia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before the First World War, and was the Bratislava itself was a place where the kings or the emperors were crowned, as I recall, weren't they?
Oh, yes, it's a great thing. Yes, the Hungarian kings had such a ceremony since the Turkish army was close to Budapest, and that is why they've temporarily moved their capital to Bratislava. And Bratislava is known because of it.
It's a beautiful city. I've been there on a couple of occasions, and I love the downtown area, the city center. It's a lovely place. A lot of history there.
Yes, absolutely. I do like it. Look, in general, Europe is beautiful because it keeps its history, and old towns in different places, not just in Bratislava, but in neighboring Czech Republic or Hungary or Vienna. Look, Bratislava is placed on borders with different countries. It's only 40 minutes by car to Vienna. It's about 2 hours by car to Budapest, or 3.5 hours to Prague. It's very close to these countries, and Poland is also close. And the geographical location is great for ones who love to travel, but nowadays the situation is certainly different.
Well, it is, unfortunately, for all of us. We're not able to get out there and do what we want in, you know, seeing the rest of the world. It's sad. So, but we can do, as we're doing today, talking electronically and also on Zoom, so I have a chance to see you in person and not just a voice. So, yeah. Where are you from originally?
Oh, originally, it's a long story. I was supposed to be born in one place. I was born in another place. As you can imagine, it wasn't up to me. Look, I was supposed to be born on the Pacific, just opposite San Francisco, on the other side of the ocean. It's a huge peninsula called Kamchatka. I was supposed to be born in a place called Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky, and it's the biggest, the largest town in Kamchatka, since my father served there in the Navy. and there is still a huge naval base there. But my parents preferred that for me that rather I would be born in Orenburg. Oh. It's in Urals, in the Ural it's a Ural Mountains region actually. It's not actually in the mountains, it's further down where there are huge steppes close to the border with Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. And since my grandmother lived there, my grandparents lived there, and since my mother was about 40 years old when mm-hmm. she was going to give me a birth, and in those nowadays it's nothing, it's just like to have a cup of coffee in Starbucks, but in those times in the Soviet Union, it was a challenge to give a birth at this age. So she needed support. My father was working hard in the Navy, so he couldn't give a full support to my mother. So they preferred to do like that. And so I was born in the Urals. And then when I was about 8 or 9 months old, we moved back to Kamchatka.
And so you were raised in Kamchatka back until, well, 8 or 9 years old. That's, you must have found a great deal of difference between the eastern part of the Russian community and the western part. Is that true?
Look, it's hard to say because we moved out of Kamchatka when I was about 4 or 5 years old.
Frankly,
I don't remember anything about Kamchatka. I could see pictures for us, but it gave me actually nothing since no memories. And I was told that, look, a couple of things about Kamchatka. First of all, volcanoes. So from downtown of Petropavlovsk, Kamchatka, you could see great volcanoes. Volcanoes, yes.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing. The second thing, red caviar or fish eggs.
No,
it cost nothing there. You could eat there by large spoons. It's like for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner. It's like, you know, potato could be more expensive there. Seriously, because it's like, you know, it's produced there. It's exported from there everywhere. And so it's an advantage. But believe me, if you eat it every day, you will hate it in a couple of weeks.
Well, caviar is considered a great delicacy around the world.
Absolutely.
And only the finest salmon, I guess it is, produce the eggs for, and the best, and in Kamchatka is the only place that the best are produced, right?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so tell me about what you first remember, because it's always interesting to me and our listeners to find out, well, we're going to be talking about serious things, but you know, you grew up, do you have brothers or sisters?
Yes, I do have a sister. She's 12 years older than me. So we grew, when I was 4 or 5 years old, she already moved, when she was 16, 17, she moved out of our family and she started her own life, and she went to study, and then she worked and studied at the same time, and then she started her own family, but we keep in touch, of course, and now she lives in Germany mm-hmm. with her family.
Now, what is the, you are a rabbi.
Yes.
How did you become a rabbi? I mean, we all know that rabbis are the ministers, the teachers, the leaders of a particular community, or unless they are in a school where they are dealing with academic issues. But a rabbi is, in essence, a way of translating that into a Christian experience is that they are the pastors of the community in which they are located. Am I correct with that?
Yes, I would agree with that partly. I do agree that pastoral care is very important. It's a certain part of my service. I don't call it a job. It's, in fact, it's a service for me. And so, certainly, pastoral care is very important. And I believe it is natural. Obviously, you could be taught to be a pastoral leader, a pastor, but it's not enough to be taught in a university, in a school. I believe it's natural. It's humanistic. It's you either possess it or not. You can develop it, but you cannot get it from nothing. But besides pastoral care, it's could be, look, being a rabbi, you could never work in the community. You can teach in the university, for instance. Mm-hmm. For instance, I studied for a year at Tel Aviv University, where I studied in English, mostly with North Americans. And I think I was the only one from Eastern Europe there. And so most of my classes were within a group, but I also had private sessions with the professor who taught me different things. But I would say in his previous life, meaning that before he started teaching at Tel Aviv University, he used to be a conservative rabbi. But then he decided that he would be more successful as a teacher at the university. So he did. I know some rabbis who retired and became psychologists. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you cannot just switch from one to another. Obviously, to become a psychologist, you need a degree, you need an education, a specific education. A rabbi could do anything. Mm-hmm. It depends.
Okay. One of the things that you mentioned, Orthodox, and there are different groupings within the Jewish communities around the world. And I think it would be helpful if you could, give sort of a summary of how the different groupings came to be and what their zeitgeist, their purpose is.
Look, I will explain. I will do my best to answer your question. But let me just say a couple of sentences for an introduction to my question.
Okay.
So first of all, there is a stereotype that the Jewish people is one and think the same. It's a great stereotype, which is not true. I would say the opposite. If you have two Jews, you will have three opinions. So, which means that sometimes we challenge each other. I mean, like, I challenge myself and give different answers. The main idea is that we like to argue. We like to discuss things. We like to evaluate things and analyze things. So that is why certainly we have different branches of Judaism. It's still called, the entire religion is called Judaism, but there are different branches, just like in Christianity. Mm-hmm. In Christianity, you have hundreds, possibly thousands of different Protestant branches. You have a Catholic Church, which also has different groups. The only thing which unites them all is the role of the Pope. But there are different branches. You cannot compare one Catholic Church to another Catholic Church. Even rituals are different sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the same with Islam. They also have different groups. And in Judaism, there are over 100 different religious groups, but over 100. But if we're talking, I'm not going to complicate the things. I will say that there are three major groups. I would say the rightest one on the right wing is the Orthodox Judaism. The Orthodox Judaism is the religion, or is the branch of Judaism, which follow strict laws which were established hundreds, possibly thousands years ago. They're very strict. Obviously, there are some more liberal among them, more orthodox among them, but generally I would say they're on the right wing of the spectrum. So, for instance, only male could be rabbis. Only men and women are separated during the service. Some groups wear particular type of clothing. Women cannot, for instance, cannot allow to show their hair in public. So, it's basically it's a strict, very strict ideas of Judaism. If I'm talking about conservative Judaism, I would say they're in the central of the spectrum. They, on the one hand, they recognize absolutely all laws, but sometimes they have a different interpretation, which kind of unite them with the modern society. Sometimes conservative rabbis are more orthodox. Sometimes conservative rabbis are more reform or liberal. So it's mostly dealing with a particular human being, whether he is more conservative or less conservative. However, women, in most of the conservative synagogues, men and women could sit together during the service. Women, in most of the synagogues, women are recognized to be rabbis. And so they kind of take everything, but they sometimes have different from Orthodox branch of Judaism interpretation. Now, finally, I move to the left. It's called Reform Judaism or Liberal Judaism. Again, it's an egalitarian, 100% egalitarian movement within Judaism, meaning that men and women have equal rights, 100% equal rights. So women and men sit together during the service. Women could be rabbis and fully serve as rabbis or as judges in the rabbinical court, for instance. And for instance, in Orthodox synagogue, women, they sit separately and they're not allowed to sing. Men, only men could sing. But in Reform synagogue, both women and men could sing together. As I said, it's 100% egalitarian. And with the regard of accepting the laws, we try to, first of all, recognize all the laws which were published, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with the laws, for instance, because we believe that the times have changed and they should correspond to modern reality, because sometimes the laws were actual 2,000 years ago, but nowadays people behave differently and people have a different experience of life. So that is why we some laws which we regard as kind of archaistic or the ones who deal incorrectly towards other religions or nations or towards women, we disregard them.
Well, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Rabbi Misha Kapustin of Slovakia currently, and we're going to be talking about how he got there. But thank you very much so far for that really interesting, enlightening discussion of the various branches of Judaism. We're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. And as I say, we're with Misha, Rabbi Misha Kapustin, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rabbi Misha Kapustin. He is a liberal, part of the liberal branch of Judaism in Slovakia. But he has also an interesting tale, which we're going to be getting into now, which is how he got there. So this is With Respect, and this is John Smetanka. So Rabbi, when you're now in Bratislava, but you somewhere in between the time that you were born in Orenburg and Kamchatka, you're growing up, you ended up in Crimea. How did that happen?
Look, when my father served in the Navy, we lived in Kamchatka. Then my father retired, and I was still a child. My father was born before the Second World War. And we moved together to Georgia, but not to America, to the state of Georgia, obviously. It was still the Soviet time. So we moved to Georgia, which is on the Caucasus. Caucasus, it's in the southern part of the Soviet Union. It's close to Turkey. And we lived there until 1991. That year, there was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the civil war was just about to break out in Georgia. And we had to escape. We have to run away from Georgia. And so we moved to Crimea. From the very end of 1991, we lived in Crimea, in Ukraine. And there I finished my secondary school. I went to university there, studied for a couple of years. I studied in Kyiv as well, in the capital city of Ukraine, for a couple of years. And then, by the way, I studied law. But I was a good student. It was easier for me than to study in secondary school because there were no subjects which I don't like. And I'm 100% humanitarian, and so I like it. Uh-huh. And I was recommended to go to enter rabbinical school in London. I remember that time. That was crazy. I was 20 years old. I had in the past 2 years of law school, and then I just said goodbye. I could have become a lawyer, but thank God I didn't. Believe me, two lawyers in a family, it's too much. What could be worse than two lawyers in a family? It's like, you know, it's a challenge, every minute challenge, you know. It's terrible. And even worse than two lawyers in a family when you have two rabbis in a family. It's even worse, 100% worse. And so I didn't have exams. I didn't have to pass any exam to enter rabbinical school. But I had a meeting with one rabbi who then was supposed to write a report. And I didn't follow any criteria to enter rabbinical school. But they gave me a chance. It's unbelievable because, look, I was 20 years old. I wasn't experienced. I didn't have a completed non-Jewish degree. I couldn't speak English at all. I was learning English for a couple of weeks before interview, just to be able to say yes or no. So he told me, look, that man, that rabbi who I still keep in touch with him, he told me, look, try next year. I said, okay. So I came to the rabbi who was sponsoring me, and he asked me, so I told him, look, next year. He told me, come next year. He said, do you know what next year means? I said, no. Next year means never. Come back. Come back. You should come back. You should insist. I'll speak to him. I'll call to London. I'll call to the person who actually decides. So they said, okay, 1 year of probation. 1 year of probation. And so during my classes, I learned English. Nobody taught me English. I was taught in English. That's different.
Well, when I studied in a seminary, and all of a sudden, when I was in college in the seminary, one day they said, "All right, from now on, all of our of our classes will be taught in Latin." Now, it was okay for me because I had studied Latin and had been exposed to it. But we had some guys in our class who had never heard Latin except in the Mass, and so we literally had to tutor them. Because our classes were all in Latin, and it was a great disadvantage to them. It was not fair. But all of a sudden, all of the religious and the philosophical courses had to be taught in Latin. But
unbelievable. Unbelievable. Look, if you're taught in English, you can practice it every day. But if you're taught in Latin, it's easier for people of Italian or Spanish background, because especially Italian background, if you speak Italian, you could easily catch it, I believe.
Yes.
But otherwise, if you come from another part of the world, if you don't know Italian or at least Spanish, then it's going to be hard. Look, I was taught Latin while I was studying in law school for half a year, but ask me anything in Latin, I'll tell you nothing. Because I realized that I will never use it in my practice. Anyway, I'm not a lawyer.
That's right. That's right. You're not a lawyer. You're not allowed to use Latin unless you're a lawyer or a doctor, you know?
Yeah, right.
So at any rate, you had studies in London. And what happened after that?
Look, I had to study really hard. First of all, it was hard because of English. For several months, I couldn't understand anything, what was going on. I couldn't understand lectures. I couldn't understand books. Look, if it's like, you know, a couple of pages I could read for a couple of hours in order to understand what it's all about. When I had to give my first presentation in English, which I was preparing for a couple of weeks, it was supposed to take a couple of hours. But I gave the presentation and my teacher told me, "Well done." I couldn't understand what it means. Well done. I had to use my translator to understand what's well done, what kind of appreciation it is. And but then I managed. And then when I understood English, another problem came. I realized how hard it is. Because if you don't understand anything, everything it's easy, but from a different point of view. But when you understand it, it's already harder. Anyway, I studied 2 years in London, passed all the exams, all the requirements. Then I did a gap year in Israel. One foreign year in Israel. I studied at Tel Aviv University for 1 year. And then I moved back to London. There I completed all the requirements and I studied for 2 more years. And finally, after the completion of 5 years of studies, I received a diploma that I have a second degree in Hebrew and Jewish studies. And besides, I received the document which confirms my rabbinical status.
All right. Now, first of all, I'm going to compliment you on your English. Certainly, it's very comprehensible. You're very fluent in English. And so those years in London helped you. It did not, however, give you a totally British accent, which is fascinating. When I teach in Europe, teach in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia, though we've never met before, and I practiced my Czech. I don't know, going into teaching in the Czech Republic, I spoke no Czech whatsoever, no Russian, no Slavic languages, including Polish, which is where my ancestors came from. But at any rate, I decided that it was necessary. It was rude for an American to come over and speak in English, just in English, to the students in the Czech Republic. So I decided to learn Czech. And so I studied, and I had a Czech teacher here who was wonderful. And she got me to the point that I could give a lecture. So after about 5 or 6 years, I decided to open up my lecture on criminal law with the following. Já jsem Jan Šmětanka, advokát a profesorka. And when I got through profesorka, all the students started smiling because I had forgotten that ka means it's a female. So I got so shook up, I stopped all of my whole lesson and I went back to English, and I've never gone back since. At any rate.
Languages, it's very fast. When I finished my secondary school, I couldn't speak any language except my mother tongue, which is Russian.
Yeah.
And I believe it's God's punishment.
Yeah.
Because he or she challenges me with languages, because I'm not a fan of languages. But the best way to learn a language, when you are motivated, when it's like, you know, when you come to England, you have to speak English, or even if you come to the United States, you have to speak the language. Basically, the idea, if you come to another land, to another country, you should speak the language of the country. It's not only about respect. It's about being able to express yourself, to get a job, to get a decent job, to feel being a part of the society. That's the idea.
It is, and I agree with you 100%. And language can give us a binding together, maybe a separation also, but a binding together of a people. It's conveyor of culture. And that's, that's part of the value of language. But I'm going to take a break right now. We're talking to Rabbi Misha Kapustin, who is rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia, located in Bratislava. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about what got him to go from Crimea, which is a part of the Ukraine, to Bratislava. Fascinating story. Now, this is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rabbi Misha Kapustin, who is a rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia, but has been there only relatively recently. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. When we broke off, Misha, we talked about your studies in London and Tel Aviv and back to London. But you eventually went back to the Crimea. Tell us, what is the Crimea? We've all heard about the Crimean War and the Battle of whatever. I can't remember off the top of my head, but the Charge of the Light Brigade and all this poetry from England about this crazy war. But it's in a particular part of the Eastern European part, which is contested between Ukraine and, for example, Russia. Each has a particular interest, cultural and historical, in that particular area. Tell us about it.
Look, Crimea is a very complicated region. When I finished my rabbinical studies, first of all, for a couple of years, I worked in Eastern Ukraine in the second largest town in Ukraine, called Kharkiv, which is on the border with Russia, but it's safe and peaceful place. But after I started, in a couple of years, I moved to Crimea since in Crimea, there were several Jewish Reform communities which needed a rabbi. So they thought, look, he's from Crimea. We're very developed in that particular region. So the people who make decisions asked me if I would like to go to my home region. And I was happy to go there, to come there, to work there, and I worked there for 7 years. So Crimea, it's from the end of the 18th century, it belonged to Russian Empire. And then, Russian Empire, just like any empire, is a totalitarian country, authoritarian country. And there were no significant divisions on different regions or ethnic groups and so on. It was Russian. But then, in the beginning of the second decade of the 20th century, the Soviet Union was created, which followed Russian Empire. And the Soviet Union consisted of several republics, so 15 republics, including Ukraine. And Crimea originally was a part of Russia. It belonged to Russian Republic. It belonged to Russian Republic until 1954. And then Crimea was one of the most undeveloped regions in the Soviet Union, at least in Russia or in European part of the Soviet Union. Why? Because if you're talking about Crimea, usually you see the beautiful sea, beaches, resorts, and so on. Yes, it's true. But it takes only about 3 to 5% of the entire peninsula. The rest of it, or about 80% of the peninsula, are steppes with no trees, with no water, with a problematic agricultural problematic possibility to do anything agricultural because it's too risky. And the most important problem was infrastructure, because there was no land border between Russia and Crimea. On the other hand, there was the land border between Crimea and Ukraine. So economically, from the economical point of view, they thought to themselves, the government of the Soviet Union decided that it would be economically better if it belongs to Ukraine and let Ukrainian government pays for the infrastructure, for the development, and so on. The main problem was water. They needed water for any kind of agriculture. So Ukraine wasn't happy to take the Crimea in 1954, but they were pushed. It was decided. So in Moscow, Kyiv was supposed to say yes, sir, affirmative. That was the deal, how it worked. So Ukraine obviously spent lots of money. Ukrainian Soviet Republic spent lots of money to develop Crimea. But most of the people, ethnically, most of the people who lived in Crimea were ethnically Russians. On the other hand, ethnic Ukrainians who lived in Crimea were kind of mostly pro-Russian. Since they spoke Russian, they didn't speak Ukrainian at home, they didn't want their children to go to Ukrainian schools, and so on. The dynamics were changed in 1991 or in the end of 1980s when the Crimean Tatars, the original nation who used to live in Crimea when it was occupied by the Russian Empire, were allowed to move back to Crimea since they were pushed away by the end of the Second World War, since some of them supported the Nazis against the Soviet Army. So the entire nation was punished, sent away to Soviet Asia. Nowadays, I believe there are about 10% of the Crimean Tatars living in the Crimea. About 25% of the ethnic Ukrainians, and the rest of them are Russians, ethnically Russians. It was a pro-Russian region within Ukraine. Look, in 2014, after the revolution in Ukraine, when it became clear that former Ukrainian President Yanukovych escaped to Russia and the revolution won, the Russian troops invaded Crimea. One day I woke up and could see that the Crimean parliament was captured by unknown men in masks and machine guns. And it was clear that they are professionals. But they didn't say anything. They acted as terrorists, but it was because since they didn't use flags, they didn't use any kind of signs to what country they belong. There are certain rules if we're talking about military operations or everything is under the law, but they didn't use any kind of signs it was clear that they were Russians. It was clear that the Russian army invaded Crimea. And then I realized that I don't want to belong to that part of the world who changed the borders like that, like in the Middle Ages. Look, in Slovakia, for instance, there are regions with high Hungarian population. In some places, you wouldn't hear Slovak language. Everybody speaks Hungarian. I believe in the United States, there are some areas where everybody speaks Spanish. But can you imagine if the borders would be changed just because a certain ethnic group constitute a majority in that particular region? Certainly, I wasn't happy about it, and I made a statement. My statement, actually, I sent it to all my email friends, without exceptions, including the ones who were living in Russia. And basically, my statement consisted of three sentences, saying that we are occupied, there are Russian troops in Crimea, and do your best, talk to your officials to react on it. That basically was my message. And within a couple of hours, it was in the news everywhere. Somebody published it without asking me. Somebody just sent it to different medias. And it became known. When we're talking, when the occupation started, and it took about 2 weeks, possibly a little bit longer, for so-called referendum, a plebiscite referendum, which was then taken in Crimea. And all the time I was living there with my family. And within that time, I gave about 50 interviews within two and a half weeks. I gave about 50 interviews to different mass media without exceptions. And sometimes I was given just one after another and to Al Jazeera, to Italian television, Japanese television, because at that time, it was a journalist mecca. It was the top news for several days. It lasted several days as the top news in the world. So they were journalists, and they wanted to speak to people, and many of them wanted to speak to me. But the harder thing was that when I was invited to a television where I used to go before, and I was live. I was speaking live with the journalist, one to one, for half an hour. So I couldn't make a mistake. I was supposed to speak very clearly and correctly. But can you imagine? I was speaking to a journalist for half an hour, but I didn't answer a single question. Since I knew that I'm watched and every word I say will be used against me. It's like in the court. I'm not, on the one hand, I'm not able to lie. On the other hand, whatever I say will be used against me. So I didn't answer at any on any question. And then when I left the television, sit down, I opened the car door, sit down in the car with my wife, and I said to her, look, I don't want to live here. I don't want to live in a place where I'm not able to simply answer the questions. Since I was afraid that it was going to be used against me, against somebody else. Because, you know, a Jewish question is very popular. And I already spoke too much. And I realized that the only decision I could make was to leave. And so we decided to leave. So we left. We took, by that time, we had two children, me and my wife. We had two children. We put a couple of suitcases, a stroller with a couple of kids, and we left. We left by train. That was the only way we could go out. We preferred to leave the car there and to leave by train, since there were no flights already from Crimea. And well, then
I want to stop because we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. And I want to continue this because it's very, very interesting. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to Rabbi Misha Kapustin, who is rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia, and he's talking about his experiences with the Russian or the whatever it is invasion of the Crimea. Back in 2014, which garnered world attention and is still an issue of tension between a number of different nations and groups. This is John Smetanka, Ron, with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rabbi Misha Kapustin, who is the rabbi of the Jewish Federation of Slovakia, who is now living in Bratislava. And he's been telling us how it was that he moved from his home country, a homeland of Crimea, into Bratislava, Slovakia. And this is, as I say, John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Misha, you got on the train. What happened?
So we came to Kyiv, all four of us. I have two children. We came to Kyiv where we got a flat, and we got a room in a flat where we could live, all four of us. And then a good friend of mine, my teacher and my colleague, rabbi from London, called me asking, look, the Jewish Federation of Slovakia is searching for a rabbi and they might like you. Are you interested in it? I said, look, I'm in Kyiv. I don't know what's next. I just knew that we had to leave. So we did it. And now I'm open. I'm absolutely open for new choices. And so, okay, then if you don't mind, I'll call you. So they called me from Bratislava. We spoke for half an hour. And then they said, look, would you mind if you come to Bratislava with your family for a couple of weeks? We will pay all your expenses. You'll have a shelter where to live. And then you'll decide if we are happy with you and you're happy with us, you can stay for some time or for some years or for whatever. And if any of us are not happy with each other, then you could leave back and no pressure. So I said, sure, why not? But I need visa. I need visa. Since I was Ukrainian and I still only possess Ukrainian passport, and I was supposed to get a visa in order to be able to enter Slovakia, European Union. They said, no problem, we will call you back. The next day, I got a call from Bratislava. I got a call from Slovak embassy. They said, look, I don't know who you are, but you need to get a visa. Because how it happened, like, you know, one man called the Minister of Culture of Slovakia. The Minister of Culture of Slovakia called the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Slovakia. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Slovakia called the Ambassador of Slovakia in Ukraine. And the Ambassador of Slovakia in Ukraine called somebody else saying, you had to complete it. So I got a visa within 24 hours.
Oh, that's interesting, because these days it takes forever to get a passport, let alone a specific visa into a foreign country that you have no history with. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, look, I got a visa, bought tickets on a train. So my wife asked me, look, shall we leave some our belongings in Kiev, or shall we take everything? I said, look, we left too much. So we take everything. This is what we have. So we took everything we had there, and we took a train to Bratislava. We came to Bratislava, and certainly, look, finally, I've been here already for more than 6 years. And so in the beginning, it was hard since I don't speak Slovak. Look, at that time, I could speak Russian, English, Ukrainian, and to a certain degree, modern Hebrew, since I mostly learned biblical Hebrew. And but Slovak language is different. Ukrainian, I mean, if one speaks Ukrainian, it's easier to speak Slovak. But my Ukrainian is awful. And it's not even, my English is better than my Ukrainian. Oh. And my English is not great, as you could hear.
No, and,
it's very good. And I'm not good at languages. Now, I don't know, I speak five or six languages, but I'm not good at it. And I hate it. So it took me time to learn Slovak. Actually, it was a challenge for me, but in the very beginning, I promised that in a year, I will do that ritual, that particular ritual in Slovak. I forgot it, but in 11 months, I was reminded that you still have a month. So within a month, I had to accomplish what wasn't done within 11 months. So anyway, I started doing everything in Slovak, teaching in Slovak, even though I didn't have enough words. I was missing the words. It wasn't easy, since Slovak is not an easy language. But no. on the other hand, it's, as for me, Czech language is even harder. Or Hungarian is even harder. I believe so. But slowly, time to time, now I speak Slovak. Possibly I speak Slovak nowadays better than English. I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to say. Thanks to Slovak, I follow Czech. I understand almost everything in Czech. But it came in three or 4 years. In the beginning, I could understand Slovak, but I couldn't understand Czech. But now I follow Czech as well.
Well, so you became a rabbi in Slovakia, and which is where you are now. I'm going to take a break eventually. We're going to a few things I wanted to talk about, but I want to do another show with you, if that's all right, because there is so much more that we can talk about your other aspect of your life, which is as a writer and as a religious thinker and as a historian, talking about, and we have exchanged thoughts about the Psalms. You've written a book or been part of a research on the Psalms of the New and Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament. And I thought that would be a very interesting thing to talk about how, in your experience, you had a lot of experience, and I've had some that I haven't mentioned with the Ukrainians and the Russians, but I'd like to talk about that a little bit later in another show, if that's all right with you.
Yes, it's certainly fine with me, but just to explain, look, I don't like writing at all. I didn't write a single word for a book, even though there are my names on them. Book, I was recording with somebody else who was writing, and then I was authorizing it. And for another book, I was just within the team. There were, I don't know, dozens of people. And they just said, look, we'll put your name, don't you mind? I said, no, I don't mind. And then it happened to be that the book was given as a gift to Pope in Vatican. And I was one of the group which was given him as a present. And then I was chosen to get a prize for that book, for the Book of Psalms. But I don't want to claim which doesn't belong to me.
We're going to let you be humble and realistic. But I do want to tell you two things. Number one is that one time in my life, I ran across a gentleman who came to see me, a very big, tall gentleman, powerful built. And we got talking and I said, by the way, where are you from? And he said, well, I'm from Ukraine. He said, but I am Russian. And I said, well, you know, I've been curious. How many languages do you speak? And he said, he looked at me and he said, well, I speak Russian. I speak Ukraine. And I speak Afghani. And I said, gee, that's interesting. How would you learn Afghani? And he looked at me and he smiled. He said, ha, 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 ha. I was in Russian army. I was Spetsnaz. That's how I learned Afghani, because it was he had spent time in the Russian army in Afghanistan when they had invaded there and had to leave. But the funny thing was that he was very courteous, but he also admired my two dogs, because he said, one dog sits next to me and watches me. Another dog sits next to you and guards you. They are smart dogs. They are very smart. But at any rate, I went to talk to my partner, my law partner, and I said, by the way, you know, you had some interest in foreign affairs and got a gentleman here, and he said he's Spetsnaz. And she looked at me and she said, be careful. He can kill you with his thumb.
Look, you know what Spetsnaz is? It's like special forces in Russia.
Special forces. It's like American Delta Forces or something.
Absolutely, like. But you don't have format. Somebody, if one belongs to Delta, it's forever. Even if he retires, he's still in Delta, I believe. So believe me.
All right, we are going to have to break now. We've been talking to Rabbi Misha Kapustin, who is the rabbi of the Jewish Federation in Slovakia. And we're going to do another show because he's such an interesting person. We have so many things to talk about, but we'll do that again later. The name of our program is With Respect, and we're on every week. And remember, our mantra until next week, our mantra is this: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.